So...
How dare you, sir? The A-10 is a superb vehicle with an outstanding history of excellent performance. In Iraq, it destroyed over 400 enemy tanks.
As a U.S. fighter pilot vet with over 4,000 flight hours, I can say that this idiot just doesn't know what he's talking about and should only be taken for the vague entertainment value he possesses.
Oh great, another Redditor with an opinion! When will these neckbeard rednecks who think they know everything finally stop and realize that—
Okay, I get it. I really do. The A-10 is everyone's favorite plane. I mean, how can you not respect this angry, grunting thing with its gigantic minigun spewing a bullet bukkake all over the faces of everyone who dares get in the way of it, all while making the sound of a hippo with diarrhea? Or an angry warthog. You know, hence the name. Warthog. Because Fairchild Republic A-10 shitting hippo doesn't sound nearly as cool. It is a plane adored by both its pilots and its fans worldwide, has been in service for almost 50 years, and there are currently no plans for its retirement. It has no equal in the world. Even its closest living rival, the Su-25 Frogfoot, which was also built around a gun, has had to go through several very serious modernization programs to keep up with it. And with the Russian military budget being the way it is, so far only 7 aircraft have received this upgrade. Though by the time I actually finish this video, an 8th might be finished. The rest are, well, stuck in the Cold War with that giant TV in the cockpit you have to aim with. The A-10, however, has received numerous upgrades, so much so that right now the A-10 is at its most deadly. More powerful than the wit of a drunk granny at Thanksgiving. And you groan. So if that's true, if this thing is capable of prizing open tanks like a can of beans, why all the hate? Why, in my opinion, does the A-10 suck? Well, this may shock you, but it has a lot to do with good old friend of the channel, Pierre Spray. Now, I've got some housekeeping to do. I made a video way back when on the legend of James Burton, a man who wasted his career trying to get a video of the then-in-development Bradley fighting vehicle exploding, so he could prove its disastrously flawed design at the hands of a bunch of generals, who he proclaimed were too busy attempting to secure extra funding and promotions, all while trying to secure promotions and extra funding for himself to build his own vehicle. It turned into one of my most viewed videos, so I guess I kinda hit a nerve. In that video, I spoke about Burton's original project, the Blitzfighter, a low-cost, low-tech aircraft designed to strafe and destroy columns of tanks with its 30mm rotary cannon. Very similar to the idea of an A-10, so therefore most people assume that this is an early predecessor to the A-10, the original idea which potentially led to its creation. It is not. The Blitzfighter was proposed by Burton not as an original idea that would become the A-10, but a replacement to it, and this is going to become important later. In that video, I touched briefly on Pierre Spray, the man who has become the somewhat figurehead of the reformist movement since the death of John Boyd. In that video, I referred to Pierre Spray as the designer of the F-15, and called him out for abusing that qualification to appear on talk shows, TV interviews, and etc. etc. I need to correct myself. Pierre Spray is not the designer of the F-15, or the 16, or the 22, or any other plane for that matter. He has never worked in the aerospace industry as an engineer, nor at the Pentagon. He is not a military strategist, nor was he ever employed in this role. He is an audio engineer, and a jazz musician operating under the label Maple Shade Records, a company he owns. Basically, he's a self-published jazz musician. The closest Pierre Spray ever got to building a plane was when he was employed by Grumman as a statistician. When Pierre Spray says he is the designer for the F-15, Pierre Spray is lying. Now, credit where credit is due, Pierre Spray did work with John Boyd as part of a think tank known as the Fighter Plane Mafia, a term coined by its founder, Colonel Everest Riccoconi. John Boyd was a known flight instructor and mathematical analyst who helped create the energy maneuverability theory with Thomas Christie. Now, John Boyd is another reformist whose qualifications are also somewhat overhyped by the group's PR monster machine, but don't worry, we'll get to him. Boyd was brought in to assist development of the lightweight fighter design project, which would later evolve into the F-15. Boyd, Spray, and Riccoconi, along with several others, were given access to the initial plans of the F-15, then known as Project Bluebird, and they did not like it. Seeing the proposed design as too large, too clunky, with an over-reliance on technology, so they proposed their own scaled-down version of the aircraft known as Project Redbird. This was an aircraft with no radar, no night vision, very little electronics of any kind, very little fuel, and no mounts for missiles. It was incredibly short range and could only operate in clear weather during the day. It was also considerably slower, being about half the speed of a proposed Bluebird. In spite of what Boyd would later claim, the Air Force utterly rejected the idea, and no changes were made to the Bluebird project. This was Pierre Spray's entire contribution to the F-15, and in all the reports, blueprints, design specs, and internal memos I've been able to look at, he is not mentioned once. His attempts to proclaim otherwise are false, and the exact features he claims were his idea changes every time he talks about it. The reason I bring this up is because Spray has a bit of a habit of proclaiming that every successful aircraft the US has ever built was designed by him. And the A-10 is no exception. Not only does Pierre claim he invented and designed the plane, he was also its biggest critic, as well as its biggest advocate for keeping it in service. So, without further ado, let's play the old Pentagon Wars music and start at the top. But before we start, we must ask ourselves the question, what is A-10? How is A-10? And where do A-10s come from? Well, when a mummy and a daddy A-10 love each other very much, they sort of hug in a very special way, and the mummy A-10 bounces around on... Oh, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not. The A-10 was designed as a close air support weapon. That's it. The army really needed something that could hang around for a long time, dropping bombs on targets designated by ground elements. And in Vietnam, this had always been the Sky Raider, but the Air Force had lost over 200 of these things, mostly due to small arms fire. Bombs were also pretty inaccurate, and dumb fire rockets were unreliable. So the idea began floating around that a rotary Gatling gun might do the trick. That project evolved in a number of weird ways, my favourite being the AC-47 Spooky, an old DC-3 transport plane from the Second World War equipped with miniguns. Three of them.
Loving you is easy cause you're beautiful.
But that could only operate at night. They needed something like a Sky Raider, but you know, better. And that was a problem since all US development into bomber aircraft had been into nuclear bombers. Because at no point had the US ever considered that they might need to drop something that, well, wasn't a nuke. They just didn't have a light bomb aircraft that could provide close air support. So the then Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, demanded two new types of planes be constructed. One that was a light bomber capable of doing close air support, and one that wasn't. The one that wasn't became the F-111 ADVA. Which a lot of people think sucks, because this poor boy has become the unfortunate target of the Reformers' media spin of hate. They claim responsibility for its retirement in 96, claiming it was cancelled because precision weapons don't work, but that's for a different video, which I will do because my boy needs justice. The other planes basically became the F-4 Phantom II, one of the most recognisable and arguably best fighter planes at the time, which was also good as a bomber, but failed to live up to expectations as a close air support weapon. You see, there's a bit of a difference between ground attack and close air support, or CAS. And ground attack means, well, you're attacking something on the ground. You're 90% sure you could have worked that out yourself, but you know, whatever. Ground attack is usually against something like a tank or a bunker or some sort of SAM site or whatever. In these circumstances, you're acting as part of an operation. You've been briefed, you know your target, you typically have something nearby escorting you, and the area that you're hitting is clear of friendly units, allowing you to rain hellfire, whatever the hell is down there. Close air support is when you've been called in to assist ground elements, either because they've requested support and you're in the area, or because you've been requested specifically. It means you don't quite know what you're up against, and there are friendlies in the area, so you have to be a little bit careful. The Phantom just wasn't quite good enough at that secondary role. Because you have no clear target and there are friendlies nearby, you have to physically identify what it is you're shooting at. And if the ground team are in a panic because they're being shot at, or have lost the radio because they're being shot at, or have in any way no ability to clearly communicate to you, the pilot, probably because they're being shot at, then you could be circling for quite a while attempting to assess the situation, which is something the Phantom just couldn't do. It was also very expensive to buy and maintain, so the Air Force began to look at cheaper alternatives. The F-4, the F-5, the Corsair, even a modified F-111. But by 1966, none of these had proven particularly effective. And what was worse, the Army was now heavily investing in ground attack helicopters, many of which have proven that they could be used to fill the gaps left behind by close air support.
Europe was paying very close attention to this, as they believed that helicopters could be repurposed into cheap anti-tank weapons platforms. In 1955, the French began experimenting with armored helicopters operating in a gunship role, but the helicopters they had access to at the time weren't quite suited to the job, so the US began developing brand new helicopters to operate in this role, and that pissed the Air Force off. The Air Force needed a plane that could fulfill these roles, lest the job of taking down tanks in Europe be given to the Army and their helicopters. The heresy. So Supreme American badass John P. McConnell demanded a design for a close air support aircraft to be studied, designed, and built, forming the start of the AX program. Now this is where things get a little bit interesting. According to Wikipedia, the main source for historical disinformation for the average mind, Pierre Spray was brought in as a technical expert and wrote the original specifications for the A-10. He came up with the idea of equipping the A-10 with a large rotary cannon instead of missiles, which the Air Force liked. The design he supposedly created was this, which you may recognize as the Blitzfighter, the aircraft that James Burton tried to pursue in the events leading up to the Pentagon Wars, described very avidly in his book Reformers Challenge the Old Guard. You may be thinking, wait, didn't Burton design that? But you said earlier this was to replace the A-10, not to create it. Yes, you are confused. The Blitzfighter is indeed Burton's design, but Pierre Spray did what Pierre Spray does best, and in his report, Combat Effectiveness Considerations in Designing Close Support Fighters, written in fucking Comic Sans, Spray claims the Blitzfighter was his idea. And he designed it. Let that sink in for a moment. There is no one, including his fellow reformists, that Spray won't stab in the back for the sake of his own ego. Just let that sink in.
What the fuck does it want now?
I'm genuinely surprised Spray hasn't been booted out by his fellow reformists, but I suppose being the most prolific member has its perks. And if there is one thing you'll eventually learn, the fighter mafia are all about that PR. Now, going back to Wikipedia, it claims that the Air Force kept Spray's involvement in the project a secret. Now, that's odd. According to himself, Spray is pretty much a household name at this point. He's working on some other projects that will eventually become very prominently known jets. Why the secrecy? Now, that's very easy to explain. There are two cited sources for Spray's involvement, the first being Karam, which is a charity built to protect children from sexual exploitation. I assume it means Robert Karam, the writer who wrote the biography of, John Boyd. So according to John Boyd, his fellow fighter plane mafia buddy Spray was involved in the A-10. The other source? James Burton. So to sum up, according to the reformers were involved in the A-10. According to the Air Force, they were not. The whole claims of secrecy was that so if I go back and get all the plans of the A-10, the design notes, internal memos, etc., etc., and find Spray is not mentioned in any of them, he could turn around and say, yes, because it's classified. No, it's not Spray. It's not, I've checked. Pierre Spray, in spite of what he and his friends claim, were not involved in the A-10 project. The Blitzfighter was proposed by James Burton in 1978, 6 years after the first A-10 took flight, and a full year after its official introduction into service. The famous cannon of the A-10 was originally also not a consideration. The plan was for a standard 20mm minigun as an arm and possibly even two of them operating in pods on the side should the weight allow it. The Air Force were not blind to the effectiveness of the minigun, especially at suppressing enemy troops and ripping through soft cover. However, the upgrade to the famous 30mm Garrett 8 and the idea of using a rotary cannon as an anti-tank gun wouldn't come until 1967, the same year that Pierre Spray claims he left the Pentagon to go pursue a career as a jazz musician. However, just after he left, something very interesting happened.
The Six-Day War between Israel and the Allied Arab nations was one of the most studied wars of its day, and the United States Air Force paid particular attention to the Israelis' use of the Mirage 3 fighter to destroy Egyptian tanks by using its 30mm cannon to punch through the softer upper armor of the T-54s, 55s, and IS-3s that Egypt deployed. Never really hear much about IS-3s, do you? T-54A tanks now began to show up in Vietnam, and having something a bit more reliable than an expensive air-to-ground missile that could destroy T-54s was highly appealing to the Air Force, so the idea of a cannon fighter was born.
Meanwhile, back in Pierre Spray Fantasyland, Spray had taken full control of the project and had laid down the specifications for an American IL-2. For this, he has made a certain book required reading for all project staff and brought the author in as an advisor. That advisor? Hans-Ulrich Rudel, a card-carrying member of the Nazi Party who helped various Nazi war criminals escape justice by smuggling them to Argentina, including infamous Auschwitz torture doctor Joseph Mengele. He became an arms dealer supplying munition to various right-wing extremist groups in South America and stood for election in West Germany as a member of the Nazi Party under its new name, the German Reich Party. What a guy. So, just to put that into context, Spray called in to assist with the top-secret US military project, a literal fucking Nazi with ties to right-wing extremist groups, neo-Nazis, smuggling, and arms dealing. This is how we know that Spray is talking bollocks. Because if any of this were true, Spray would have been fucking arrested. This is leaking secret military information to an arms-smuggling Nazi. You cannot make this shit up. Ah yes, welcome to the Pentagon, Dr. Oberlieutenant. These are the plans for our new plane. What's that? You want to go back to Argentina to talk with the Horton brothers? By all means, why are you taking so many photographs? Ridiculous. But let's assume for a moment that this is true. Spray wants to build an IL-2. I think this, beyond anything, really kind of highlights Spray's total lack of understanding when it comes to military history, in particular, the performance of various military vehicles, to the point where I wouldn't be surprised if I learned he had, at one point, petitioned the US military to start building King Tiger tanks.
Because they were the best tanks of the war!
Russian IL-2s developed the idea of ground attack aircraft, strafing tanks with rockets and cannon fire. They became known as the Terror of the Skies, often racking up more kills than the tanks on the ground. The idea was later copied by the Germans with the Stuka mounting cannons. It's a very romantic vision, and like many facts of the Second World War, it is nonsense. Though most pilots claim ridiculous amounts of kills with their cannon-mounted aircraft, the supreme champion being Hans Ulrich Rudel himself, who claimed to have personally destroyed over 500 Soviet tanks all by himself, even though this is not backed up by the Soviets, who show no record of having lost that many tanks to aircraft, let alone a single Stuka. In fact, the kill records of most ground attack pilots were somewhat, exaggerated. To give you an example, the main British ground attack aircraft was the Typhoon, equipped with 40mm cannons and a number of 60-pound rockets. 20 squadrons of Typhoons were scrambled during a major counterattack by the Germans at Mortain, Normandy. The Typhoons flew 294 missions, firing over 2,000 rockets. At the end of the day, they claimed 84 destroyed tanks, 35 probable, and 21 damaged. This was the day of the Typhoons, claimed Charles Green of 121 Wing. And no bastard can take that away from us. Sorry, Charles, I'm that bastard. For when the British post-battlefield investigation teams whipped in, they found that only 43 tanks had been destroyed. And of those, only 70 had been clearly destroyed by Typhoons. The other 7 were completely undamaged, having simply run out of fuel or been abandoned by their crews as the Germans retreated. And this was a problem that continued pretty much throughout the war. Post-investigations of battlefields could rarely back up the claims of the pilots. And during major battles, it was found that overall they achieved roughly 20% of the kills they actually claimed. German tank ace Otto Karas claimed that whenever he saw Typhoons, he really wasn't worried as the rockets only hit with luck. And it was not just the British pilots. Russians, Americans, French, even German pilots suffered the same issues, with Russia eventually launching an investigation into the so-called ghost kills of their aircraft. Found that when IL-2s fired a barrage at a tank, if the rocket missed, it would still create enough of an explosion to shroud the tanks in flame and smoke, obscuring it from view and giving the impression it had been destroyed, even if it was completely unharmed, and allowing the plane behind it to strafe the same tank and think the same thing. Meaning more often than not, the entire wing claimed to have killed more tanks than were actually present on the battlefield. Though I may do a full video on this later, it is safe to assume that the myth of the tank-busting aircraft is just that. A myth. But, as we all know, what happens in World War II does not directly affect what happens in a modern setting. And besides, those aircraft were armed with primitive rockets and cannons. The A-10 operates on an entirely different level, and even if the World War II planes were ineffective, the principle was sound, wasn't it? In 1979, a live fire test was initiated, results of which you can read here, and I'll leave a link in the description since I really should be citing my sources for this shit. 10 M47 Patton tanks were placed in a rough triangle formation, mimicking that of a Soviet tank column during an assault. A single A-10 was deployed with the pilot making 10 passes, and allowed to fire as much ammunition as he wished. It was a clear day, the tanks were unmoving and in open terrain, and each one was fully combat loaded. God damn, it's almost like Burton commissioned this test. And the pilot was given sufficient time to come around into each pass at the best possible attack vector, effectively the ideal conditions as dictated by Fairchild Republic. And the results? During the test, the pilot fired off 174 rounds, making a single pass to attack each tank individually. Of those 174 rounds, 90 hit their targets, or 50%. Out of the 90 rounds which then hit their targets, 30 achieved penetration, 8 of the 10 tanks were actually hit, and 3 were destroyed, with the other 3 becoming immobilized. On closer inspection, it was revealed that of all the penetrating shots that hit each tank, that only 1 or 2 rounds were able to make lucky hits penetrating the fuel tanks or the ammunition, and all of those shots hitting the rear of the tank. It was considered that of all 3 tanks immobilized, all could be made operational again on the same day. It was also claimed that had these tanks been M60 patterns instead of the highly outdated M47s, only 1 of the tanks would have been destroyed. And against the more modern Soviet T-62s, which share a very similar profile to the M47s, it was theorized that the Gau-8 would have been next to useless, especially considering in a real-life situation the Soviet tanks would be moving and deploying smoke, and with the A-10 only able to make a single pass. You see, in a Soviet tank column, the supporting heavy AAA units are typically concentrated to the rear. This was the case during the A-10's initial development, but by the time it was deployed, Russia had...
В автоматы входит почти 2000 выстрелов.
I feel like I show this footage every video now. It's almost like the reformers forget this thing exists. Well, Pierre and the other reformers were not fully aware of the true reality of ground attack aircraft in World War II. The US and Europe were. When the 1979 live fire test came out, interest in the A-10 began to dry out faster than Ben Shapiro's wife's vagina. There was also considerable issues with the structural stability of the aircraft. During stress testing, the frame began to develop some serious fatigue flaws. It was an easy fix, but shortly after, large cracks began to develop along the wing struts. Afterwards, fatigue issues continued to be a bit of a problem, and the aircraft was partially redesigned with a thicker outer skin. But by then, the damage was done. The reformers began to distance themselves from the aircraft, and international interest in sales of the A-10 dropped to zero. Even Sweden, which had been looking into creating their own version of the A-10, cancelled the program before it could, get off the ground. By this point, even Congress was starting to ask questions. The Army was completing their attack helicopter program, and though the Cheyenne would eventually be cancelled due to the massive gaping flaws in its design, the Apache would rise from its ashes. The Marines had also just purchased the British Harrier jump jet, one of the first and only times America would purchase a foreign design. Congress now wanted to know why the Air Force needed a third close air support aircraft. The Air Force dug in their heels. They needed something that could slug it out up close and personal with anything on the ground in an environment where return fire was a guarantee. Also, there were some politics over funding and what have you, but we don't have time to get into that. Congress relented, but after yet more tests on the A-10's wear and fatigue, production halted in 1984. It seemed like the A-10 was gearing up to be a failure. And then, in 1991, freedom happened.
Peace sells, but Saddam isn't buying.
The 1991 Gulf War is the single most successful military campaign in modern history. The Iraqi army was well-trained, well-armed, and they were the fourth largest army in the world with about 4,000 tanks. They presented a formidable foe. And right off the bat, as the build-up to the war began, the comparisons to Vietnam began. This was to be Bush's Vietnam, a war that would take decades, cost thousands of lives. And in the middle of it, Pierre Spray claimed that the US M1 Abrams tank was completely untested, that no live fire demonstration had been performed, and that it would be vulnerable to the more proven and battle-hardened Iraqi T-72s. He petitioned for a return to the patent M60, and rather thankfully, his words fell on deaf ears. The Abrams proved to be the superior tank, and in spite of Prey's predictions, the Americans' new tank utterly dominated. At one point, a group of 9 Abrams moving in open planes with no cover took on 28 Iraqi tanks in heavy cover with support and with the element of surprise, and destroyed all 28 of them without taking a single loss. The Battle of 70 Easting would see over 160 Iraqi tanks destroyed, with the only recorded Allied loss being a single Bradley. In a single month, America had broken almost all previous records set by the Second World War. The ground war had lasted just 100 hours and was concluded with a total coalition victory. The Iraqi forces had been humiliated. And very suddenly, the perception of war, and more prominently, the perception of Soviet technology, often considered cutting-edge, battle-proven and reliable, began to very quickly lose its shine. But the war presented an opportunity. Leading self-proclaimed experts had all predicted a years-long brutal campaign which would end the presidency, and they'd be made to look like idiots. So it was time for a massive, and I mean massive, PR campaign. And thankfully for the reformers, they had a secret weapon. The Gulf War had been largely won down to air power, and while it also presented some of the biggest tank battles in US history, the Battle of Kuwait International Airport, where thousands of Iraqi tanks were destroyed to a single Abrams tank being slightly damaged, a large bulk of the tanks had been destroyed by air power, and the reformers were there to capitalize. It's only here we now start to see the claims made by Pierre Spray. William S. Lind had now joined the reformers. He was less cut and dry than the others and acted more like a middleman, introducing the group to James L. Fallows, the Washington editor for the Atlantic Monthly, who had become quickly enthralled by the reformer stories and would cheerleader their cause for many years to come. Lind would then go on to create the Congressional Military Reform Caucus, cementing the fighter mafia as an official sounding group. And while most reformers did not believe in the idea of close air support, Spray had, according to Air Force magazine, been an early proponent of it, arguing that the Air Force needed more. And in an interview with Atlantic Monthly, Spray proclaimed that as early as the 1950s, he had argued for a close air support aircraft that would fly close to the ground, taking advantage of hills and riverbeds to avoid radar detection. After the Gulf War, Spray used this to distance himself from the other reformers, who had now a reputation for wasting funds to prepare for a fantasy war of World War I style flying circuses, to place himself as the key figure in the development and the design of the Gulf War's underdog gone champion, the A-10. After all, if Spray had been an advocate at the time the Air Force was thinking on the same lines, then it's very possible, certainly very probable, that he would have been made aware of the X-1 program, and very probably he would have been asked for an opinion. Even if the company he worked for at the time, Grumman, did not submit a prototype and had nothing to do with the AX program. In the late 80s, Burton emerged onto the scene, you know, remember him? Bringing with him the famed Blitzfighter prototype. Burton proposed this as a cheap replacement to the then failing A-10 and surprisingly got a lot of encouragement from his Air Force rivals at the time, but was ultimately laughed out of office. Burton's tantrum after being rejected is infamous, and the Blitzfighter, supposedly designed by Vault, though there's no evidence of this as Vault take no credit for his design, passed into infamy. After the Gulf War, with the reformers having now been proved wrong in absolutely everything they claimed, Spray decided to reinvent himself. He was now an engineer, the designer of the A-10. He appeared to proclaim that the Blitzfighter had been his original prototype, and that only through constant interference Pentagon War style from the upper echelons of the Air Force had he seen his beautiful design move away from its origins of simplicity to the more lackadaisical A-10 we see today. Thankfully for him, at the time, interest in the A-10 was at an all-time high. The newsreels had been flooded with footage of bombers, and none had quite struck the imagination like the A-10. The strange-looking aircraft with its gigantic rotary cannon strafing tanks on the ground with its signature noise. And Spray lapped it up. What began here was a signature fighter mafia PR spin. People wanted to know more about this aircraft, and the media were happy to provide. Spray was interviewed, documentaries were made, and each time the focus was not on the missiles, but on the gun. The A-10 was a gunfighter. The gun could destroy tanks. It was also highly protected against flak, and could take a direct missile hit and be fine. And if only Pierre Spray had had his way, then every US aircraft would be capable of doing the same. So Spray had nothing to do with the A-10 project, in spite of what he and Wikipedia may claim. He remains, as he always has been, an angry old man talking on subjects he has no real idea about, as anyone with even a basic level of knowledge has realized, claiming to have been a major part in the development of some of America's most famed fighter jets because someone once probably asked his opinion, taking credit for other people's work so he can demand money to appear on various news programs and talk shows to fund his true passion of selling overpriced audio equipment to hobbyists. Spray has amassed a legion of fans by pretending he was the whiz kid of the Pentagon, the man who knocked heads together and shot the fireworks up the asses of generals too stuffy and money-obsessed to produce anything of value, who if it were not for him and his fellow renegade fighter plane mafia boys, would have produced expensive money pit machines incapable of performing at the very basic levels of military requirements, just as they will always so proudly proclaim, just like the F-35. What he fails to mention is that he and his fighter plane mafia buddies were the money pit.
The people brought in and protected by their friends as they wasted millions in taxpayers' money pushing for outdated concepts they had monetary interests in, all for the benefit of their own egos and careers. The Fighter Mafia continued to hold conferences at the Officers Club in Fort Myer, where they brag about their influence over many people who still hold high positions at the Pentagon, or even advise various NATO leaders, including the US Navy, Canada, and Australia. They even sell their books there and tell those young officer cadets who line up to buy them to fly under the radar. By which they mean do what I say, but pretend it's your idea. If it was up to Burton, Spray, and the others, if the Pentagon had taken them seriously, if their designs were implemented, the US would have been at a total technological disadvantage over the Soviet Union. And many people, people much smarter than I am, have theorized that under Spray's guidance, the death toll of the 1991 Gulf War would have been in the tens of thousands, and could have possibly even been lost. Spray is not the maverick whiz kid he and his PR campaign have made you believe. He is not the designer of the A-10. Alexander Cartavelli was the designer of the A-10, seen here with his entire team. You'll note the absence of Spray. Cartavelli was the main advocate for close air support, the true hero behind the creation of the A-10, and someone who Pierre spits on every time he fails to mention who it is he's stealing credit from. Cartavelli was the designer of the P-47, the F-34, and the F-105 Thunderchief. He died in 1974 from a heart attack just 2 years after watching his final project take flight. He was the true maverick of his day, the true genius, and he has become a footnote in history. His Wikipedia page does not even mention the A-10, and it has taken an enormous amount of work by various dedicated individuals across the globe to preserve his name, as Spray and the remainder of his Fighter Mafia buddies have taken every opportunity to dance on his grave and delete him from history, all so that they could claim his work as their own. Also a boring, pathetic little man, can cash in a few royalty checks and feed his ego as another half-assed production on the history of the A-10 begins. And that brings us back to the main topic of this video. The A-10 sucks, and if it was up to Burton and Spray, it would have been even worse. I want to break down the A-10's performance into three segments, but I've been talking for quite a while now and my throat really kind of hurts now. This video took a lot longer to produce than I thought, since every time I go digging, I find some new report, and every single one I read seems to add yet more layers onto the bullshit pile of the A-10's development. So I'll leave that for part two, coming whenever my mental health decides to, you know, exist. Thank you very much for watching. Don't forget to dislike and tell me to go fuck myself in the comments.
And so really matters to me. Take a look around. You're out of touch. I'm out of time, but I'm out of my head when you're not around. You're out of touch. I'm out of time, but I'm out of my head when you're not around. Ho ho ho. Ho ho ho. Ho 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 ho. Rest of the song.